You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire. 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Koutou katoa, ko Max toku ingoa, no mai haere mai, ki te Wire, mō tēnei rā. Kia ora and welcome to The Wire for Rā for Wednesday. Not only is this a Best of The Wire special, but it is also my final Wire, as I won't be returning to the station next year. I'm also joined by producer Manny and producer Flo. Fiakine coming up on the show, for our weekly catch-up with the Green Party, I spoke with MP Ricardo Menendez March to discuss what the Green Party... The Green Party's reaction to the latest homelessness report released in Auckland, the government's takeaways. Sorry. We talked to the Green Party. As I said before, this will also be a Best of The Wire, where we look back at our favorite interviews from current and former hosts and producers on the show. In June, former Wednesday Wire host Spotto Otto spoke to an Iranian New Zealander living in Iran, going under the alias Mariam, to discuss Israel launching missiles inside Iranian territory. And in September, I spoke to John Minto from the Palestine Solidarity Network Aotearoa to discuss US President Donald Trump's leaked Gaza Riviera plan. Manny, what do you have for us today?
In October, I spoke to Professor of Conservation Biology James Russell on preparations made to prevent an explosion of predator species when the beech trees fruit next year.
And Flo, what have been your favourite pieces this year?
Thanks, Max. Earlier this month, I spoke to University of Auckland researcher Kirsten Tillerman about the safety of queer people on public transport.
Hey, aho o whakaro. I would love to hear your thoughts on any of these pieces, so get in touch. Tukupatuhi mai, text in on 5395. Kaua e wareware e ahe ana koutou, te whakarongo ki ene kōrero anō, he pakeheri rokiroki, maronga i te pai, tukutuku o irirangi pōho me haere ki 95BFM irakati.com. You can catch all of these stories and more by podcast on the 95BFM website, 95BFM.com.
Now it's time to hear from the Green Party's Ricardo Menendez March.
Here's what we spoke to the Green Party about today. Yesterday, the latest 6-monthly survey of housing support providers under the National Homelessness Data Project, or NHDP, showed that homelessness in Auckland has more than doubled in the year to September. The report also found that 14 of the 21 agencies interviewed reported an increase in homelessness. As well as this, Australia's ban on social media for children under 16 has taken effect, and according to an interim report into social media harm, a social media ban for children in New Zealand is also worth exploring further. And last week, the government announced the replacement of the Resource Management Act, or RMA. The coalition said its replacement will slash red tape and supercharge growth. For our weekly catch-up with the Green Party, I spoke to MP Ricardo Menendez March about the government's new RMA reforms and a potential social media ban in New Zealand. But first, we discuss the latest report on Auckland homelessness. What is the Green Party's reaction to the increased homelessness in Auckland and the figures released by the NHDP?
As we head towards the holiday season, it's a tragedy that the government has yet to take accountability for the fact that decisions such as restricting access to emergency housing have directly contributed to an increase in rough sleeping. And what is the saddest thing here is that the government has also refused to acknowledge almost over a year now, reports from the front lines who have told him and his government that things are getting harder as a direct result of government decisions. And at the end of the day, what we're talking here is people's livelihoods, young people who are growing up under homelessness. And this is something that is also completely possible to fix. And this is what we're committed to fighting hard next year to address it.
When you say things that have been done by the government that have directly made homelessness worse, what are you talking about specifically?
Absolutely. So this list. So the first one would be tightening the eligibility for emergency housing. So as somebody who worked the front lines and has supported people to get assistance from work and income before being an MP, I saw firsthand already how difficult it was for people to access emergency housing. People were already being asked to show that they had alternative suitable accommodation. And the government made it even harder for people to access emergency housing. The truth is that most people don't choose or aspire to live in motels. It's often a last resort for people. When you deny access to that assistance, often the only other place that will exist for people to sleep in will be the streets. But we've also got other decisions that the government has made, such as, for example, increasing benefit sanctions, which remove one of the few lifelines for people to make ends meet. And if you strip someone's ability to survive, they won't be able to pay their rent, and that ends up being a pathway towards poverty and eventually homelessness as well. So there are government policies that they've been warned that will make things worse for those that are already struggling to make ends meet, and the government has completely ignored those warnings and now is ignoring the accounts from the front lines that things are getting worse due to government decisions.
The report highlighted that government budgeted funding for homelessness support in the current year to June 2026 has reduced by $79 million compared to June 2025. What are the Green Party's thoughts on the reduced funding despite the increasing homelessness?
That it shows the government is more interested in spending billions of dollars for tax cuts to landlords, caving to the tobacco industry and to the fossil fuel companies, and addressing issues that our country faces, such as homelessness, low wages, the closure of our manufacturing industries, and the things that allow our economy and our communities to be well. And so the government's got their priorities upside down, and they are spending far too much money and resources on caving into big industries as opposed to helping out everyday people make ends meet.
Associate Housing Minister Tama Potaka said in a statement, "The report findings reinforce what the government knows of homelessness as a complex issue, and that the government is taking action to address the real issues." Do the Greens have faith in the government to fix the real issues as described by Tama Potaka?
Tama Potaka is being increasingly glib about the realities of homelessness. Sure, it's a complex issue, but at the same time, the solutions are not that complex. Often the solutions involve ensuring we have enough public housing, which this government is chronically underfunding and, in fact, cancelling many of the projects. It's about ensuring that people get the support that they need. That also means not making it harder to access emergency housing. And it also means ensuring that people have legal means to survive, which also means not cutting someone's benefits. And so I think hiding behind the idea that this issue is complex while actively undermining the services and the supports that exist to prevent and address homelessness just reeks of disconnect. And I think people can see through the glibness.
If the Greens were in government, what can you guarantee would be done to fix the growing homelessness in Aotearoa, New Zealand?
We would reverse the changes that the government has imposed that will make it harder for people to make ends meet. But also we're committed to supercharging our public housing program to ensure that we build enough public housing for everybody who's currently homeless and in the housing waiting list. We will also overhaul the welfare system and introduce a guaranteed minimum income so that students and people outside of full-time employment can live outside of poverty and can have the means to thrive. These are the commitments that we have made through successive elections, and we will fund them by taxing the wealthy few so that we can have services that people can access, like healthcare.
All right, moving on to the next topic. Australia's ban on social media for children under 16 has taken effect, and according to an interim report into social media harm, a social media ban for children in New Zealand is worth exploring further. My next question is, do the Greens support a social media ban for children in New Zealand?
We don't, actually. And this is one of those issues that is indeed quite complex, because the reality is the ways in which the social media bans have been implemented or are looking to be implemented here in New Zealand, for example, would rely on things like age verification. We know that young people are able to get around the systems in place to access social media, and the people who need to be held to account are actually the social media giants who have time and time again ignored expert advice on issues like how their algorithm is set up, how they moderate content to ensure that we're not exposing young people through the algorithm, for example, to harmful content on social media. And banning young people from social media won't actually go to the core and the root of the issue, which is how big social media corporations behave and the choices that they make that end up creating harmful online spaces for young people.
What can be done to regulate the tech giants, as you're talking about?
Better transparency and regulation of how the algorithm is used is a place to start. Increasing the use of moderation online, for example, would be another step in the right direction. Building literacy and around online harm is another thing that can be done. And at the end of the day, why banning isn't an option either for us is the reality that for marginalized groups of young people, online spaces are actually one of the few places where they can find connections. And we are ignoring the fact that for many young people, actually online spaces can be a safeguard when their lived realities outside of online spaces are simply unsafe or people don't have access to the connections that they need to be well.
When it comes to Australia's ban, what should we be watching to judge its viability?
Well, whether young people are actually able to circumnavigate the ban, which we're already seeing reports on, but it's also whether outcomes for young people end up improving in the medium term, because I don't think we have the luxury of just waiting to the long term to make a call. But this goes around, for example, reports of mental well-being, reports of whether people feel more or less bullied online, whether people have less harmful interactions, but also reports around how young people are connecting to each other and to the world that they're in. And we know that for queer and disabled young people, for example, the online spaces can be a really important space for them to find connection and to get a sense of being understood. And so these are the things we must keep an eye out and be willing to see through the nuances of this issue.
Okay, moving on to the final topic. Last week, the government announced the replacement of the Resource Management Act, or RMA. The coalition said its replacement will slash red tape and supercharge growth. My next question is, are the Greens happy with the coalition's RMA reforms?
So there's kind of two components to this, right? There's the urban planning component, and I think it is important to acknowledge that we haven't had good urban planning in this country for quite some time. And so we acknowledge that reform needs to happen in this space. But actually, the things that have prevented good urban planning often sit outside of the RMA. And what we're most concerned about the RMA reforms overall is the fact that they have completely sidelined our titidity obligations, and they haven't actually committed to an adequate long-term view and protection of the environment. And so my colleagues, Julian Genter and Lansan, have been fighting in the House around this, but also to try and build consensus around the need to overhaul our RMA legislation to ensure that it puts adequate urban planning, environmental protections, and safeguard and titidity at the forefront.
What kind of message do you think that sends to Māori in New Zealand that the government have chosen another decision that goes against titidity, especially when I think I saw Luxon say earlier this week that he was trying to enhance Māori rights in New Zealand as well?
I don't think anyone will believe Luxon when he says he's enhancing Māori rights when he's passed through the Regulatory Standards Act. He entertained the Treaty Principles Bill. He actively has championed and supported removing titidity clauses in several pieces of legislation. And when it comes to RMA reform, the important thing that to note around titidity and the connections to it is that at the end of the day, these are pieces of legislation that have to do with decisions on how we interact to our natural environment and to the land. And so when we take out titidity from those pieces of legislation, we're effectively sidelining the people who have kaitiaki rights over the whenua and end up making decisions that do not uphold the rights that Māori have over the land. And I don't think those, the environmental protections and good urban planning are not mutually exclusive to looking after titidity. And this is why this is so tragic, because the government has chosen to sideline our obligation to titidity under the guise of better urban planning.
The government is claiming the environment will still be protected under the new reforms. Do you agree with that, or has this made it harder to protect the environment?
This has made it harder to protect the environment, but more than anything, I think the government needs to come to terms with the fact that overall, the track record on environmental protections is increasingly poor, and the long-term impacts of weakening environmental protections will be felt through generations to come, whether it's through lesser access to safe drinking water, to swimmable rivers, to having the biodiversity in our oceans that we need to ensure that we can keep our species safe and that we can keep having access to kai moana. But also, you know, we're seeing already the impacts of our lack of adequate wastewater infrastructure by mussel farmers having their livelihoods being put at risk due to contamination in our oceans. So these are all things that have been made worse under this government, and the longer we keep those problems, the harder they'll be to fix.
That was the Green Party's Ricardo Menendez March on the latest report on Auckland homelessness, a potential social media ban in New Zealand, and the government's RMA reforms from last week.
That was the Green Party's Ricardo Menendez March. Fantastic.
Great.
Super.
The best of The Wire on 95BFM.
We're going back to June for our first Best of The Wire piece, when ex-Wednesday Wire host Otto spoke to an Iranian-New Zealander who was in Iran at the time, going under the alias of Mariam, while Israel was launching missile strikes on Iranian soil.
Last Friday, Israel launched a series of missile strikes on Iranian soil aimed at destroying Iran's nuclear facilities and assassinating their top generals and scientists. In response, Iran fired a series of their own missile strikes into Israeli territory, striking areas like Tel Aviv and the port city of Haifa. Both countries have attacked civilian areas in this round of fighting, with Israeli strikes into Iran hitting Iran's state broadcaster in Tehran, as well as the Farabi Hospital in Kermanshah, killing at least 200 people, with Iran strikes targeting a number of residential areas in urban Israel similarly. I spoke to an Iranian New Zealander who was currently in Iran at the moment, going under the alias of Mariam for her safety and security, who talked to us about her experiences trying to flee Iran and contacting the New Zealand government for assistance.
To begin, can you describe the situation in Tehran right now from your perspective?
From my perspective, it's absolute chaos, and no one knows where to go that's safe. There's shortages of fuel, clear directions on where to go, where not to go, what to do, what not to do. So everyone's just basing their opinions on what other people are saying. We got the order to evacuate from the New Zealand embassy yesterday, which we did. I was in the District 3 area, so I've evacuated outside of Tehran. We couldn't go too far because of the traffic as well. So we're close by where we could possibly get hit or not. We don't know.
So just to reiterate, have you and other people in your situation been able to access shelter easily?
I would say no. I mean, the only places we have is like our homes, and that's it. Nowhere safe. There's no bunkers. There's really nowhere besides the only thing that the Iranian government has told us is you can shelter in the train stations. That's it.
Right. Can you describe the process of evacuation and what evacuating has been like for Iranians and Iranian New Zealanders such as yourself who are trying to leave the country at the moment?
Well, when we got the email to evacuate, we literally started scrambling everything together, just trying to get everything together so we can leave. And while we were doing that, within the next 5 minutes or so, they started bombing the area that we were in. So we just literally rushed just to leave Tehran. We didn't know where to go, where it was safe. So we ended up leaving and we went to a city close by south of Tehran. And when we got there, the locals said that everyone here left as well because there's missiles around here. So we left that area. We came to another area, which I don't know if it's safe for me to say where or not. It's just south of Tehran. So that's where we're at the moment. But we don't know if it's safe here. For how long it will be safe, we don't know.
Can you describe your experiences with contacting the New Zealand government or the Ministry of Foreign Affairs at this period of time?
I contacted them the first day that this whole thing happened, and they didn't really tell me what to do besides you can either stay put, stay in Tehran, seek shelter, or you can leave the country, which is something that we advise. But how do I leave the country? I've been trying to leave the country by just getting to the Turkish border, but there's Literally no buses, no trains, nothing to get there. I was arranging a private taxi to take me to the Turkish border yesterday, but we got the email to evacuate. Now I'm currently in this tiny little village. It's just impossible for me to get to the Turkish border right now. So the only thing I'm asking the New Zealand government to do is try to find a way to evacuate its citizens that's currently trapped in Iran. And I believe there's 46 of us here currently.
Do you think that the New Zealand government has responded adequately to the situation in Iran at the moment?
I would say no. Comparing it to citizens from another country such as America, Australia, Canada, no, New Zealand has not done what it needs to do to ensure the safety of its citizens. So no, I'm quite sad about it because I had this feeling of having a New Zealand passport could give you safety, but right now I feel like it doesn't mean anything.
What do you think the government of New Zealand could be doing to ensure the safe passage of Iranian New Zealanders who are in Iran at the moment?
Honestly, if they can just arrange a way for us to get to the Turkish border somehow, that's all that we're asking for. Just get us to the Turkish border, somehow do that, because we can't do it ourselves. It's becoming very impossible to do that. Once we get to Turkey, it's fine. We'll figure something out.
Are there any other options for Iranian New Zealanders at the moment to flee the country?
No. I mean, anywhere you go in Iran is just not safe. So the only thing we can think about is getting to the Turkish border. And there are other borders as well. But I don't want to get political. I don't want to get into reasons why we don't want to go that route.
I think that's about everything from me. But is there anything else you'd like to mention before you finish off, or any calls you'd like to make to the New Zealand government?
I would like the New Zealand government to ensure the safety of its citizens and actually have a plan, do something about it, not just pretend that they care. That's all.
And that was Mariam, an Iranian New Zealander in Iran, talking to us about the Israeli-Iranian conflict in her perspective and her attempts to contact the New Zealand government for assistance.
We'll be right back after this short break. Keep it on the B.
Here at 95BFM, we ran out of ideas for merch, so we got the kids to do it. And honestly, the future of graphic design is in excellent hands.
We've just dropped a 95BFM kids show tee, and it's been designed by one very talented kids show listener. Thanks, mate. We've also got staple tees and hats available to purchase. So get your summer outfit sorted and pre-order your 95BFM merch now from twotonesmerch.co.nz.
Hello, my little sparrows. If you're listening right now, then this message was meant for you. Claim it if it resonates. I've got my tarot deck here. I'm going to pull a card to illuminate an intention for you. Just shuffling. Ooh, it's the B card. This card represents prosperity, greatness, clout. Oh, I love this for you. Expect an abundance of free things. Music, merch, coffee, ticket.
Get a B card today from 95BFM.com for just $4.20 a month and be in to win tickets, albums, and more.
The Hard, Fast and Heavy Show.
Oh, beloved woman of liberty!
2 hours of punk, hardcore, goats, doom, metal and thrash. The Hard, Fast and Heavy Show. 11 p.m. to 1 a.m. every Sunday night, only on 95BFM.
Some current affairs age like fine wine. The best of The Wire on 95BFM.
Welcome back to The Wire on 95BFM. Please let us know your thoughts on any of these pieces today. Text in on 5395 or call us on 309 3879. For our next Best of The Wire piece, we're taking it back to September, when US President Donald Trump's Gaza Riviera plan was leaked to the public. To discuss this, I spoke with John Minto from the Palestine Solidarity Network Aotearoa. Earlier this week, the Washington Post published a leaked prospectus for a Gaza Riviera plan that had been reportedly circulating the White House. Named the Gaza Reconstitution, Economic Acceleration and Transformation Trust, or GREAT, the plan included a forced displacement of Gaza's entire population of 2 million people, as well as the territory being placed into a U.S. trusteeship for at least a decade. Although it's not yet clear whether the plan reflects US policy, it seems to match US President Donald Trump's previously stated ambitions to clean out Gaza and redevelop it. Critics of the plan identify it as a blueprint for mass deportation and ethnic cleansing of the Palestinian people disguised as a marketing development, and that if the plan were to be executed, it would include international war crimes on an unimaginable scale. To discuss what the leaked plan says about US foreign policy under Trump and how Aotearoa as well as other countries should respond to this, I spoke with John Minto, co-chair of the Palestine Solidarity Network Aotearoa. What was your initial reaction to seeing this leaked plan?
Well, the initial reaction, of course, is that what the plan represents are massive war crimes against the Palestinian people, because if that plan were to go ahead, it would mean the ethnic cleansing of 2 million Palestinians from Gaza, and that would be simply a war crime to drive people off their land so that you can take over the land for some, developing some, you know, theme parks and business activities. So it's the signalling of the intention to conduct a massive war crime against the Palestinian people.
Many people are seeing this plan as an excuse for ethnic cleansing, and that a plan like this proves that US President Donald Trump has no issue with that. What do you make of this?
Yeah, I think that's true. I mean, Trump has been very clear that he wants to create a Riviera in Gaza. He's got a real estate mindset, and he doesn't see the people. He just sees economic opportunity for investors to make huge profits out of off the backs of the Palestinian people, as Israel has been doing for 76 years. So I think at the moment it's not an official US policy, because I think they're waiting to see if they'll be able to implement it. And Israel similarly would love to implement this policy, but I think many of their people and certainly Palestinians are saying no way it's going to happen. And if that's the case, then it simply won't get off the ground. And at that point, the Americans will say, oh, well, it was never really our policy anyway. But this is clearly their intent. This is what they want to do, and this is what the world must stand against.
The leaked plan was reportedly developed by Israelis, but it matches what US President Donald Trump has previously stated about his ambition to clean out Gaza and redevelop it. What does it tell you about US foreign policy under Trump that a plan like this has potentially been considered?
Well, it tells us that the Trump administration sees everything in economic terms. There's no morality, there's no justice, there's no human rights considerations, there's no international law considerations. It's simply, where are the economic opportunities for American money and for American investors? And they're seeing Gaza as being part of that. So I think it shows the moral bankruptcy of the US administration. And it's important to say that this is not just Trump. I mean, America, I think Trump represents America with its clothes taken off. In other words, there's no pretense any longer that America is acting in a way which is moral and just and, you know, leading the so-called free world. There's none of that. They're simply there with sort of naked political ambition on behalf of the billionaire class which run the US.
Do you believe that there can be an end to this conflict with US involvement, or is that concept not possible anymore?
Well, certainly there will never be justice if it is left to America, because you'll have America and Israel on one side of the table, Palestinians on the other, with the rest of the world with their hands tied behind their backs, voluntarily in the case of New Zealand. And there will never be justice. So I think American involvement will only be positive if there is enormous international pressure to hold Israel and America to account for what they have done in Gaza. So it won't be America left to its own devices that will solve anything. It will be massive international pressure on America, which will force it to force Israel to uphold international law and to allow for Palestinians to have equal rights in Palestine.
What should New Zealand and other world leaders take away from this plan being leaked and even suggested in the first place?
Well, I think we should take away from it that there's no morality here in the US position. Certainly the vast majority of people in the world just look at that and they see a European country, which claims to be the great moral leader in the world, as nothing more than an empty society with economics driving everything. And in particular, the wealthy capitalist class, the 1% in America, they want this Gaza plan. They want a world where there are no restrictions on the movement of their money, and they want opportunities to make more money. And those opportunities they see in this Gaza plan, which is being floated by the US.
What does a solution to the Gaza conflict look like from your perspective?
Well, I think the absolute immediate priority must be sanctions against Israel. Our government at the moment is dangling the idea of New Zealand maybe representing a Palestinian state as some kind of step in the right direction. But in fact, that's a distraction from the need for sanctions against Israel. We will not end the genocide by recognizing a Palestinian state. We will end the genocide when Israel's held to account under international law for what it's done and what it is doing in Gaza. And the way we do that, hold Israel to account, is to apply sanctions on Israel. And Western countries such as New Zealand, by failing to apply sanctions, are in fact not just complicit in the genocide, they're holding hands with Israel as Israel conducts a genocide. So it's we've really lost our moral way in the world. New Zealand used to speak out very strongly on the right side of history on issues like this, as we did in the case of South Africa, as we did on our anti-nuclear policy. But we've lost that completely with this current coalition government, and we desperately need to get that back. The people of New Zealand want the government to put sanctions on Israel. The public opinion polls show that, but the government is refusing.
That was the PSNA's John Minto on the leaked Gaza Riviera plan and how it shows that leaders such as Donald Trump prioritise development and investment opportunities over morality.
Glad we don't have to worry about that anymore.
The best of The Wire on 95BFM.
Every few years, Aotearoa's beech trees, that's B-E-E-C-H trees, produce a great surge of fruit that feeds many of our native birds, but unfortunately also our pests. And once the beech fruit is gone, the predators will turn their eyes onto our protected species. This coming year, 2026, conservation experts are expecting a mega fruiting and are gearing up to suppress what they expect will be an explosion of predator species that will come with it. For my best of The Wire, I talked to Professor of Conservation Biology at the University of Auckland, James Russell, to understand this upcoming conservation effort. So, to start us off, the mega beech mast that's coming up, could you give our listeners a bit of an overview of what it is, really?
Mast seeding is a really interesting reproductive strategy that a number of plant species, some of which we have in New Zealand, use. In New Zealand, we have beech forest and tussock grassland, and what they choose as a reproductive strategy is rather than just predictably going every year where the predators can key in on it and know that it's going to come, they kind of wait what seems like randomly, and then just once every couple of years, they just drop all their seed at once in huge numbers. And so the things that would usually eat that seed and stop it turning into plants is unable to respond to that in time. So it's a really good evolutionary strategy, and scientists have recently discovered that what generates that is it's actually the temperature differential. So it's not actually random. The plants sort of have an internal body clock that says, oh, there's been a big change in temperature from last year, so I'll use that as my motivating cue to drop all my seed next year. And so the challenge with this is when all of this seed drops, it creates this trophic fountain which explodes up the food chain, and then all the animals respond to it, some of them being the animals we want to get lots of food, but some of them being ones that we don't want to feed up, such as the introduced predators.
So we get a huge explosion in population from both native species and these predators. In the long run, what sort of impacts does this have for our conservation efforts?
So before humans arrived in New Zealand, this was a really good strategy which New Zealand birds and other animals evolved towards. So they knew that if they just bided their time and waited until these mass seeding events happened, they could have bumper years. So species, particularly parrots and parakeets, such as kakapo, kaka and kakariki, they would wait. And when all that seed comes, they would explode in numbers and have a really great reproductive year that would see them through for many years to come. The challenge is when introduced predators arrived, they also benefited from this and they realised that they'd stay at really low numbers, but when these big seeding events happened, there'd be all this food. So rats and then stoats would explode in numbers in response to this. So for a while, that's okay, as the rats and the stoats are just competing with the other native birds for these seeds. But then what happens is the seed stops because the mass seeding is completed for the year, and then all of those introduced predators turn around and go, oh, well, we're really hungry still and there's lots of us. How about all you birds that have just had lots of babies? We're going to come eat all of you now. And so that's that huge problem where we see that negative repercussion, where the mass seeding event, which would usually have been good news for our bird species and still is in the Kakapo program, for example, turns into bad news a few months later when the swarm of predators turns on them.
So is this quite a significant part of the conservation headspace if you're thinking about protecting birds or protecting Tonga species, that this is a core moment?
Over the last 20 years, we've really realised it's pretty critical in terms of preserving our bird species that we have an awareness of this. There's generally two types of forest across New Zealand. We get what's called podocarp and or broadleaf forest, and that's what dominates in the North Island. And it's when you go down to the South Island that you see a lot more of this beech forest, which is where the mast seeding happens. The podocarp broadleaf forest tends to follow a more normal, regular pattern of just seeding and fruiting once a year, although they too can have good and bad years to create a bit of unpredictability. But it's really down in the South Island that this beech forest has these major mast seeding events. And in this case, it's not even just the whole of the South Island will do it this year. It really comes down to microhabitat and that temperature differential. So DOC now have the models to forecast where these mast seeding events are going to be strongest. And for this one coming up this summer, they know that that mast seeding is going to be happening basically from the top of the western, northwestern South Island all the way to the bottom in Fiordland. Mast seeding is a really interesting experiment in ecology. We learn a lot about natural systems, so it's been really great that we've been able to do what's called fundamental science and just understand what's the ecophysiology that motivates these plants to seed. It used to seem random to us, but now we understand it's this temperature differential. And then it's a great example of how someone working on fundamental science was able to translate that and work with applied scientists who were saying, this is really a problem that we have these explosions of pests following these mass seeding events. How can we use that fundamental science to help us better predict our monitoring and when we have to do this implementation? So it's really been quite good that we've been able to now translate that science over just 10 or 20 years into really applied management to stop these extinction events. And in 1999, in the top of the South Island, they lost the last population of mohua or yellowhead because we just didn't know how to predict these events or how to respond to them appropriately.
Right. And with our growing ability to predict them, are we seeing any connection to things like climate change, or is it more of a relative year-to-year thing?
The role of climate change in this is really interesting because it's a temperature differential effect, climate change shouldn't make it more or less common. Although the hot years will get hotter, the cold years will also get hotter. So it's still about that difference between the hottest hot year and the hottest cold year. So we shouldn't see a greater change in mast seeding events from it. But what we are trying to do is, as the new frontier in pest management, is rather than just having these pests pulse through every few years and eventually decline our populations through to extinction, is move from what's called pest suppression, which has been the predominant model in the New Zealand mainland, pest suppression where you just crush the numbers down to very low numbers and stop them exploding. We want to move towards something that we do on the offshore islands of New Zealand, which is called eradication. And there's this in-between ground called elimination, which is where you might not be able to find every last individual and eradicate them from the North or South Island today. But what you can do is eliminate them so that they're no longer able to find others to breed with. So they're at such low numbers that even when these mass seeding events come through, the animals aren't able to breed up because they just can't find each other. So this is really an interim step that we're applying at the moment as we work towards a predator-free New Zealand where we might actually be able to eradicate these predators from New Zealand. And there's parts of New Zealand already, particularly down in South Westland, so Franz Josef and Okarito townships and the surrounding forest and farmland, where these rats have now and stoats have now been eliminated and they just can't find each other. There's still the odd one that comes through down the road or crosses over a stream or comes over the mountaintops, but it can't find anyone to breed with. So that's a really exciting frontier, which just gives us another tool to conserve our native species. DOC do great work translating that fundamental science into applied management outcomes. I think the real critical thing we're looking at is return on investment or bang for buck. So how much does it cost per year to suppress pests per hectare and having to commit to that in perpetuity versus how much can we pay to eliminate these rats from the landscape. So, for example, if we can eliminate rats from the landscape and then keep them out for $100 per hectare per year, that's pretty much a bargain basement price and something we could actually afford across the whole of the country.
With 1080, I know that there are some people out there who feel very strongly about it. How do you approach that issue?
Ultimately, we're doing this conservation, I like to think, first and foremost for the birds, but we're also doing it for people. It's people making decisions for the birds and enacting those on behalf of the birds. So the use of toxins that people have created is fundamentally a human-centered decision. So I really like to work with communities, and that's what we've seen through Franz Josef and Okarito. There's communities, there are people there that were resistant to poison use, but people have sat down with them, had a lot of cups of tea that ironically have 1080 in them at trace levels, and said, look, if we move to elimination, we just get to use 1080 once, and then we don't have to come back and use it every 3 years or every 5 years with mast seeding events. If you just let us use it once and we pursue this elimination strategy, then in the long run we can stop using toxin, which is better for the environment and better for animal welfare. So that's really what I'd like to move towards. But at the end of the day, it's just about having a conversation and making sure people are on side and that their concerns are addressed and they don't feel sidelined in the decision making about pest management and conservation.
Right, so lots of consultation with the community. On the 1080 and the tea, what's going on there?
1080 is a naturally occurring substance. So what happened was it exists in tea and eucalypt. And I think I did a back of the envelope conversation once that if somebody managed to drink 200 cups of tea in a day, they might start to feel some impact of 1080. But if you've drunk 200 cups of tea, you're probably going to have other bodily function issues coming up first. But then scientists realized that it did have toxic effects at very high dosages. So that's what scientists did back in the day. They extracted the toxin and learned how to synthesize it in the laboratory so they could manufacture it. And then obviously everything is a toxin at high enough doses. We've all heard the joke about how if you have too much of that horrible chemical H2O, then you might keel over. But it's all about really just the dose response.
That was Professor of Conservation Biology at the University of Auckland, James Russell, on the Beach Megamast. We'll be right back after this short break. Keep it on the B.
To make it right.
Kia ora. Kia ora and welcome back to Best of the Wire. Once again, please let us know your thoughts on any of these pieces. Text in on 5395 or call us on 309 3879. Public transport is at the forefront of many discussions in local politics. The expansion of bus routes and train systems are crucial infrastructure projects within our growing city of Tamaki Makaurau. However, public transport can also be a dangerous place, especially for gender and sexual minorities. With the future of our cities being tied into further public transport, it is essential to ensure that the systems work for everyone and ensure everyone's safety. For my Best of the Wire, I spoke to Kirsten Tillerman, a University of Auckland researcher, about the risk of violence towards LGBTQI plus people on public transport earlier this month.
The Best of the Wire on 95BFM.
A new study from the University of Auckland has indicated a higher risk of violence and discrimination for queer people on public transport, with non-binary transgender people or those with multiple marginalised identities being affected the most. Kirsten Tillerman, PhD researcher at Waimata Taupapa Rau, University of Auckland, conducted the study and is working with Auckland Transport to address the issue. To further explain the results of the study and to describe the implementation of possible solutions, I spoke with Kirsten Tillerman. What do safety hazards on public transport look like for queer people?
So for queer folks, you've got all the same hazards that everyone who rides public transport looks at with additional layers. Because queer folks can be read as that in public life, that can mean people are targeting them for challenging gender norms, for being out with a partner that doesn't fit binary or heterosexual norms. It can mean for trans folks, challenging those gender norms, maybe having a voice that is not expected, and just basically for living our authentic selves, being out on public transport, it can mean that we're targeted for different reasons that are driven by transphobia, homophobia, those rigid gender norms, all the isms on top of what's there already.
So what inspired you to start the study and focus on this issue?
Well, the first study that I did on bystanders looked gathered input from women in general, and I found that there seemed to be also some differences coming from my participants in that study who identified as part of the rainbow community, but I didn't quite have enough information to really dig into that. So the next study I designed, I wanted to specifically do it within the community and be as inclusive about that as possible, because I found that there's not actually a lot of information out there about the experiences of the rainbow community, of harassment and other forms of violence on public transport. And so this was an attempt to help fill some of that data gap and therefore help public transport authorities and professionals make better informed decisions about the programs that they design.
Within your findings, is there a time period, for example, on weekends or certain times of year, where the violence is found to be worse?
I can't say that in a quantitative way because this was a qualitative study, but as is probably not surprising, participants did talk about generally feeling a lot less comfortable during darker hours, during the nighttime. And there was also kind of a two sides of the same coin conversation around Pride Month, where it was nice to see a bit of like visual support for the rainbow community, but also this kind of sense of unease that it might make folks just a bit more aware of it, and folks that are triggered by that sort of thing more likely to actually target people during Pride Month. So it's all contextual, but there are some patterns there.
In your study, you have analyzed how marginalized communities are more at risk of violence, especially queer communities, yet responses usually do not focus on these communities. What would a response focused on rainbow riders look like?
Yeah, well, one of the things that I think was so amazing to hear from my participants is that the queer community is very trained or very experienced at looking at bigger pictures and looking at more layered approaches. So it's not just that we need to respond to making sure that we see representation in the posters or the communications that go out that very clearly communicate that protections include the queer community and everyone, but also that it's not just lip service. So we talked about this systematic approach, this community-based, so that there's this shared responsibility for safety around it. And I thought that was something, I found that was really unique in the conversations around this, of this shared responsibility, not just only these are the things that public transport agencies need to do, which is true, but also what we can bring as riders and as a community to be able to look out for each other and create an environment where it's harassment that's not welcomed on transport, not people who are typically marginalized by society. We want to welcome those folks on public transport.
So that was part of the active bystander approach, I believe, that you'd mentioned in your study, trying to get other riders, I guess, to show more solidarity. How do you think we can encourage the solidarity in action from other passengers?
Yeah, well, I think it definitely has to come from not only the community, but there has to be public transport authority tools in place first. So I'm never going to tell someone to put themselves in harm's way, but the public transport authority, if there are ways to report incidences as they're happening, that is one way. You can be an active bystander without actually getting actively involved, but there that pathway has to be in place. There's also ways to have more resources like transport staff available on hand, and help buttons, and then the staff to have training as well, so inclusive service training and de-escalation. And then once those are in place, then there's also an avenue to provide more information about how passengers and riders can step in without putting themselves, again, in harm's way. That's indirect approaches like causing distractions or going up and talking to the person who's being harassed, ignoring the perpetrator so you're not escalating anything, or just stepping in between a situation to block that line of sight often can just diffuse something that's starting to escalate. But that all requires first assessing the situation for danger and to assess what you feel comfortable doing as well. And that might just mean recording what's going on so that you can have an account of it to provide after the fact, or checking in with the person after the fact if it was something that happened quickly.
So I'm guessing that's part of the systems level approach. At the same time, work from the community itself as well as from the public transport agency.
Yeah, absolutely. That sort of shared responsibility where the public transport authority is saying, these are the things that we provide for you. These are safety tools. We're also going to get you from point A to point B. We've got your back. We understand that these things happen. We're going to take them seriously. And we also expect this type of behavior from you. And if we see that that is breached, we're going to come up, back up and enforce it in kind of a tiered way. Like, obviously, if it's not, like, not everything demands like kicking someone off the system or calling in police, but like handling things in a step up sort of way.
Is there more violence on public transport compared to, let's say, just on the street in the evening?
In general, like, I don't have the like quantitative data to say that specifically, especially specifically here in Auckland. But in general, what we see on public transport is just reflective of the risks that you see outside. So I would say that it's not more risky to be on public transport. Now, it's just a slightly different situation, because if you're out on the street, for instance, you have a little bit more option to leave. You can move. If you're on like a moving vehicle, you can't just jump off a moving vehicle. At the same time, when you're on public transport, there might be other protections in place, because you have, if it's a bus, there is a bus driver there. There might be other riders there. So it's kind of a give and take. But in general, I would not say it's more risky on public transport than out on the street. They're kind of go hand in hand.
Yeah, and you're currently working with Auckland Transport on safety initiatives. What kind of time frame were you looking at there? When are you hoping that some of your new ideas and initiatives might be implemented?
Yeah, well, I'm sorry to disappoint. I can't give a specific timeline outside of my control, but I can say that I have been working with Auckland Transport over the last about year. And the reason why you haven't seen anything like bright and flashy and like huge changes right away is because Auckland Transport's wanting to do it right. They're not just wanting to be able to say, oh, we did this, without actually having the systems in place behind the scenes to back that up. So they're taking a systematic approach to make sure that they have those systems in place. They've cataloged what's already there and are starting to put out communications for that. They're also exploring options for adding additional measures, and then making sure that as they're designing those, we're getting input from a diverse community of riders. The hope is next year you'll start seeing things. I'd feel comfortable saying next year in 2026.
That was Dr. Kirsten Tillerman, a University of Auckland researcher, speaking about the risk of violence towards LGBTQI+ people on public transport.
That was The Year That Was, the best of The Wire on 95BFM. That was The Wire.
Ko ira te hōtaka katoa mō tēnei wiki, nei te mihi ki a koutou katoa I kōrero mai ki au mō tēnei rā. That's a wrap on the Wednesday Wire for 2025. Thanks to the Green Party's Ricardo Menendez-March for speaking with us today, and thank you to those who have spoken with us in 2025, including those in today's show. An Iranian New Zealander going under the alias Mariam, John Minto from the Palestine Solidarity Network Aotearoa, Professor of Conservation Biology at the University of Auckland James Russell, and University of Auckland researcher Kirsten Tillerman. Nei rā hoki te mihi ki a koutou e whakarongo ana. Thanks for tuning in to The Wire, and thanks to everyone who tuned in to the show during the past year. And thank you to everyone who's helped me with The Wire since I started producing and later hosting this year, including everyone at 95BFM, our producers Manny and Flo, our original 2025 Wednesday Wire host Otto, everyone who's listened to me on The Wednesday Wire, and one last thanks to our news and editorial director Joel. The Wednesday Wire will be back in January next year. Happy holidays to everyone, have a Merry Christmas, and a Happy New Year.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.